From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Trump meets with Kim Yong-chol, North Korea's former spy chief and a close aide to leader Kim Jong-un, at the White House in this hour. And the spy chief is expected to be bearing a letter from the North Korean leader for the American president. The envoy also met yesterday with Secretary of State Mike Pompeo in New York. They're working to pave the way for the June 12th summit between Trump and Kim, which President Trump called off last week, telling Kim in a letter to, in effect, give him a shout if he wants to restart talks. Kim apparently is doing just that. NPR's diplomatic correspondent Michelle Kellerman has been following all of this. She joins us now. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, Robin.
So lots of meetings, some at the demilitarized zone between North and South Korea, some in Singapore, where this summit is hoped to take place. And yesterday, as we said, in New York. What came out of that one? Do we know?
Well, for one, this invitation for Kim Yong-chol to come here to the White House to deliver this letter in person rather than having Pompeo bring it back. And Pompeo told us yesterday that he thinks that he's making real progress on all those in all those talks that you mentioned. He personally has now had three lengthy interactions with Kim Yong-chol, and he's met twice with Kim Jong-un, both times in Pyongyang before. And Pompeo says he thinks these men are contemplating, that's the key word, contemplating, a strategic shift. You know, for years, North Korea has relied on its nuclear weapons program as a security guarantee. Pompeo has been trying to convince them that they're less safe with nuclear weapons rather than more safe, but that's a really hard sell.
Well, this isn't the first time the U.S. has tried to talk North Korea out of its nuclear weapons program, but it's also not the first time they've exchanged letters. President Clinton sent a letter through a special envoy to North Korea's leader near the end of his presidency, 1999. It's so interesting to read about it now because the mission was to deliver a proposal, I'm looking at a report in 1999, that the 50-year-old economic embargo against the country, North Korea, be lifted gradually in exchange for a series of major concessions, including the North ending its long-range missile program. That was the issue back then, now nuclear. Do we know what is in this letter from Kim Jong-un to President Trump?
Well, we don't know yet, but as you say, this is kind of a typical way to respond, to talk with these direct messages. I would expect some very broad offers, like what Kim Jong-un has said before, that he's open to denuclearization sometime in the future, perhaps. What that means to him and what that means to the U.S. is very different, and I'm not sure we're going to see that kind of fine print in a letter like this.
Right. Well, the president has spoken about needing many summits to hammer out a deal. And you were in an event with former Ambassador Joseph Yoon today. He had this to say about the administration's diplomatic strategy.
Two key words that Secretary Pompeo used was process and progress. And that is very different from earlier on, a few weeks ago, when we talked about let's all do it in one go. So you can see the internal dynamics that is going on within the administration as a result of communications.
And Michelle, I'm wondering if it's as a result of a lot of reporting. We've been seeing reporting from people who've been working on this for decades, who said things like denuclearization could take 10 to 15 years. Does it appear that President Trump and Mike Pompeo have softened their calls for this immediate denuclearization?
Well, I think they have. I mean, the language has certainly changed. Remember, it was just a couple weeks ago that administration officials were talking about this Libya model, that North Korea should follow that example and give up its nuclear weapons all at once and then get benefits. That didn't go over well. Then we started hearing President Trump say, as you just mentioned, that maybe we'll need, you know, more than one summit. And that's what Yoon, who was most recently the U.S. envoy on North Korea, was telling us today. He said, you know, one sign of success of this summit, if it happens in Singapore, will be, you know, we agree to meet again. Yeah. That's sort of the diplomatic success story.
We have less than a minute. I'm just wondering what the mood is, because it's kind of incredible that we have the former spy chief of North Korea going to the White House, you know, just weeks away from the president calling his leader Little Rocket Man.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. You know, some of this stuff has been happened before. They've had talks before. But the thing that's never happened is having a summit like this, a sitting U.S. president and a leader of North Korea. That's a big new element. And these are both men that sort of love the drama. Yeah. So we'll see if it happens.
And the spy chief in the White House. NPR diplomatic correspondent Michelle Kellerman, thank you.
Thank you.
And the other big global story we're following today, world leaders responding to news that President Trump has put tariffs on steel and aluminum imports from Mexico, Canada, and the European Union. Today, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau called the tariffs an affront to his country and totally unacceptable. And another ally, French President Emmanuel Macron, called them illegal and a mistake. Susan Danger is CEO of the American Chamber of Commerce to the European Union, a group that represents U.S. companies with trade and investment interests in the EU. And she joins us now from Brussels. Susan, welcome.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
You're representing some of the biggest names in American business. What are they telling you about the effect these tariffs will have?
Yes, we represent U.S. companies invested in Europe. Some of them have been invested here for more than 100 years, so there's a huge commitment to Europe. About more importantly, to the overall EU-US relationship. We are opposed. We have been speaking out quite vocally on this for the last weeks and months, in fact. So now, of course, very disappointed with the decision that was taken.
Why? Lay out your argument. Why are you against these tariffs?
This seriously risks now igniting a dangerous escalation in trade disputes. I think we're already seeing that with the talks now of imposing retaliation measures. This is harmful for everybody. This is a no-win situation for either side. We're very concerned because the EU-US relationship is so important for business that we don't want to see this suffer.
Yeah, the EU, in fact, says it will retaliate. It's got this 10-page list of American products that it plans on putting its own tariffs on, including products like Harley-Davidson motorcycles, a company which, by the way, is one of your members. I mean, do you think the EU response has been appropriate?
It's not really for US companies invested here to comment on the response that's been taken, but what we would say and what we have been saying, that any response has to be balanced. What we would really like to see, which has been happening, and both sides, certainly the EU side has been trying, is for the sides to work together to try to find a solution, because we do recognize that we have a common agreement that there are challenges with regard to global overcapacity, mm-hmm. as well as potentially unfair trade practices. But we really need to work together to find a positive agenda to take us forward.
And what do you make then of the argument that the U.S. is making here, that this is an issue of national security because the U.S. market is flooded with cheap foreign metals? It sounds like you're saying there's some truth to that, at least.
No, we don't buy in at all to the claim that this is a national security issue at all. We're each other's staunchest allies. The EU and the US are completely bound by history and values. We have been for now 70 years or more. We need to remember that this entire relationship supports 15 million jobs on both sides of the Atlantic. So do not buy in at all to the national security argument.
What about the imbalance of the foreign metals hurting American companies?
I can't comment on the imbalance there. We recognize again that there is an overcapacity issue globally. So it is a problem for both sides. Mm-hmm. It's this that we have to address. We need to stick together with regard to also the global trading system that needs to be strong also to resolve any of these issues. We feel very deeply as well that working unilaterally to try to solve such a problem is not the way forward. So again, working together has got to be the solution.
How do you think American companies that rely on European steel and aluminum will manage these higher costs that they could be facing?
I think we've got one of the dangers now moving forward, which is why we are concerned, is about the implications of the knock-on effect. You know, we need to remember how interlinked the two economies are and the supply chain issue. I think it's underestimated to a certain extent of how bound all companies are. We're talking big and small here, and the implications this has for small companies, let's bring that into the argument, SMEs. In fact, you know, 93% of business is taken up by SMEs. Absolute implication here with harmful knock-on effects on jobs and growth with this regard.
SMEs meaning small businesses.
Absolutely, yes. Small and medium-sized enterprises is what we call that over here in Europe.
You've mentioned the strong relationship that the United States and the EU have had for many, many years. Do you think that this has the possibility of doing lasting damage to that relationship?
I would hope not. I think what we have to do is continue stressing how intertwined the economies are. I mean, 54% of global investment in the US comes from the EU. This is absolutely crucial that we continue this for both economies. 45 of the 50 US states export more to Europe than they do to China. So remember how important it is for these two continents and two economies, which together are the largest economy in the world, that they must stay intertwined and stay together.
Susan Danger is CEO of the American Chamber of Commerce to the European Union. She's joining us from Brussels on a Skype line. Susan, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
After game one of the NBA Finals last night, social media went wild. The Cleveland Cavaliers were tied with the Golden State Warriors, but J.R. Smith thought they were ahead. So he dribbled out the clock. A screenshot of LeBron James made the rounds, his face seeming to say, "Do I have to shoot for you too?" Poor Smith. The Warriors won in overtime. But before last night's game, NBA Commissioner Adam Silver addressed the Philadelphia 76ers investigation into President and General Manager Brian Colangelo, who's been accused of using five fake Twitter accounts to criticize his own players. Here's Silver.
I have talked to management at the 76ers, and the notion here was, let's find out what's going on. And I said, in anything we've dealt with over the years, I think you have to separate sort of the chatter and sort of what either fans or, frankly, the media are saying from the facts.
Let's bring in Femi Oke, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. And Femi, start our social media roundup here, because this all started after an article by The Ringer, the online sports media site.
And they started looking into the story because they had a tip-off about a number of Twitter accounts that had so many similarities that they thought they have to belong to the GM of the Sixers. What were the similarities? Well, linguistic turn of phrases, inside information about the players that nobody else could possibly know. Some of the telephone numbers associated with the accounts all ended with the same two digits. The accounts followed were very similar, and also the way that the accounts tended to defend the GM himself. That got them thinking, that got them digging.
That's a giveaway. Well, Colangelo is saying he has no knowledge of some of the other Twitter accounts, so we'll follow that story. But I want to get to the new study from Pew Research Center, which finds more teens are leaving Facebook for other platforms, YouTube, Instagram, Snapchat. I am not surprised because I'm seeing them on the platforms especially that disappear. But Pew found roughly half of U.S. teens use Facebook. And it used to be something like 70-80%.
When they did the survey 3 years ago, most teens were on Facebook. And then the top three were Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat. And now Facebook is at number four. And anybody who works in social media or is trying to get a young audience, they already know this. Facebook is not a cool place to hang out. This was before all of the transparency issues, the privacy issues. Kids did not want to be on the same social media platform that their granny is on, yes, or their mum and dad are on, right, or their mum is friending them, or their dad is friending them. So they get off to places where people and the older people don't know how they work. Snapchat? How does that work?
Right. Well,
Instagram?
Not...
What's the point of that? Right. That's where the teens are hanging out.
Right. There you go. Before we go, Francis Spider-Man. What an incredible story. This immigrant from Mali who scaled an apartment building in Paris to save a young boy. A whole crowd was watching underneath. I started thinking, what would I do? What would I do? This little boy, a four-year-old, was dangling from a balcony. This 22-year-old Mamadou Gassouma, he climbed up, saved the boy, and then spoke through a translator this week on France 24.
No, I wasn't thinking about being brave. I just did what I had to do. I had to save him.
Well, Femi, President Macron gave him citizenship. He's a migrant. Gave him a job in the fire department. Incredible story. He scaled it in 30 seconds. But there's been some discussion about what about other migrants?
Of course. And on Twitter, the applause for Mamadou was huge, and people were sharing the video, and it went viral. Adam Clark says this should be the new image of African immigrants. And then the other description and the other discussion is really about, hang on a minute, do African immigrants, do any immigrants have to do superhero feats in order to be accepted? That was the question that was running around Twitter and also amongst netizens as well. It's a criticism of, oh, it takes this for you to appreciate what immigrants have to bring to French society and, in fact, any society where immigrants currently are facing pushback.
Yeah, you see them racing around the nation trying to save people. Femi Okeh, host of the stream on Al Jazeera English, thanks as always.
You're always welcome.
All right, how about some TV? The second episode of Showtime's new documentary, The Fourth Estate, airs this Sunday. The series by veteran director Liz Garbus follows New York Times journalists as they cover the first year of the Trump administration and the paper's own struggle with allegations of sexual misconduct against one of its star reporters. NPR TV critic Eric Deggans has been watching. Hey, Eric.
Hi.
The only reason this is so interesting to me is because of the way the profession of journalism has become so politicized in the last election and during this administration. How does the series portray that?
Well, the point of the series is to take a look at the newsrooms of the New York Times in the first year of the Trump administration. So the focus is on how they're covering the president, how they're covering politics. And one of their most visible reporters, of course, is Maggie Haberman, this reporter who's been called the Trump whisperer for her long connections to Donald Trump and her ability to break stories about what's going on inside the Trump White House. So we spent some time with Maggie and we see the toll that the job is taking on her personal life. And I think we even have a bit of tape of her talking about the job. Let's check it out.
I'm really tired. This is a long time on the Trump tour. I had this whole idea of what was going to happen. So the election would be over, you know, and according to our statistical modeling, Clinton was going to win, and then I would, you know, get to just kind of go back to life, and that is not what has happened. I'm so tired. Like, but I also, like, I don't really know how to stop at this point either.
Yeah, so what we're getting here is a picture of what it's like to work in a place where you're constantly covering a hot story. I think the documentary gives you a sense of how media works, how journalism works, how a publication like the New York Times can report out the stories it does.
I'm glad you played that clip of Maggie Haberman because I wanted to ask you if you think it serves reporters like her and, frankly, the New York Times in general, to let a documentary filmmaker follow them around as they're doing this reporting on this huge story. Because one of the mantras, as you know, of our profession is not to become part of the story.
Well, in the documentary, they are the story. and media has become a huge part of the story. Of course, the New York Times reserved the right to vet the final version of the film, which normally you don't do.
Which, by the way, the Times would never allow the sources of their own stories to do.
That's right. You know, and they do make films and do other kinds of media. But I do think it does give you a window into the Times that normally you wouldn't have. It's just – it's a window that you can tell is very carefully managed, even though they do show embarrassing moments. They show when they get beat on a story or when James Comey goes before a congressional committee and says that they got a story wrong and then they have to scramble to see if indeed what he said was true. They show that stuff. But you still get a sense that you're not seeing anything that the Times doesn't want you to see. And good documentaries shouldn't be like that.
So maybe some problems there, which leads me to this next issue, which is that the final episode features the Times executive editor Dean Baquet as he's trying to figure out what to do with White House reporter Glenn Thrush, who had been accused of harassing female journalists.
When we saw the story, we had a conference call. We debated how to respond. There were women quoted in the story who felt aggrieved. I just felt like until we understood what happened, we had to just suspend him. And everybody on the line thought that that was the case.
Thrush now back at the Times working on a different beat. And we should also say NPR itself has dealt with sexual harassment in the workplace. But, I mean, do you think the documentary does a good job confronting some of the other major problems that the paper is facing? It sounds like you're saying maybe it doesn't.
Well, I think the Thrush situation is a good example. You know, obviously, it's very tough to let documentary filmmakers film all the details of a very delicate personnel matter. But the result is that it's hard to get a sense of exactly who he was accused of harassing and why exactly did the paper decide to suspend him instead of firing him. There's a moment where Bacay is on a conference call and someone on the conference call says, well, why didn't you fire him? And he says, well, we just take each case individually. Hmm. Which wasn't really much of an answer, right? It was his way of explaining that they couldn't adopt a blanket zero tolerance policy for harassment, but it didn't explain why they didn't fire him. And frankly, I don't think the Times has done a good job explaining to the world why they didn't fire
him. So do you think that the series will help critics of the paper and critics of the industry in general, like, see this conversation that we're having about the profession any differently?
I think if people go into watching this film with an open mind, they will learn that, you know, reporters aren't sitting around making up sources. They're working very hard to get stories right. I do think that some of the lessons about this situation are happening on the margins of this documentary, meaning that, for example, they show one of their political reporters, he's hanging with Steve Bannon. And the reporter tells him that he just got a book deal about people like Bannon who are trying to challenge the Republican establishment. And you get the sense that is this reporter really going to write a story that would upset Bannon when he just got a deal to write a book? You know, it's those kinds of things that people can sort of see happening where they sort of go, well, are these people too close to each other? Does the media have an incentive, a weird incentive to play this game in which the politicians are attacking the media is incisively covering the politicians, the resulting attention sort of ramps up the success of the media outlet, and it also helps the politicians become more powerful. You can see at the edges of this narrative that that's happening, and in some ways, those moments can be the most enlightening moments of the film.
That's NPR TV critic Eric Deggans speaking with us about the new Showtime documentary, The Fourth Estate. Eric, thanks.
Thank you.
Planet Money tip number 17. A great analogy doesn't have to make sense.
Busier than a one-legged bobcat covering up his own crap on a frozen pond.
Didn't you just make that up?
Well, yeah. I
just... Planet Money, a poetic podcast about the economy.
The U.S. unemployment rate hit an 18-year low in May, dropping to 3.8%. It marks only the second time unemployment has been this low since 1969. The Labor Department's latest job report also says the economy added 223,000 jobs, and that beat economists' expectations. Mike Regan is senior editor of Bloomberg News, and he joins us now. Mike, welcome back.
Thanks, Peter.
223,000 new jobs and unemployment still falling. Economists must be feeling pretty good today.
Yeah, it's definitely an impressive number, especially given the context of where the economy is right now. I mean, you have to remember the economy has been in a growth cycle for about 9 years now, when the unemployment rate at 3.8%, the lowest since the year 2000. And this would have surprised a lot of people, at least in the days before the administration's pro-cyclical policies that have come into fruition. It would just be surprising that the economy would continue to add 200,000-plus jobs when the unemployment rate is this low. The expectation was that the growth would just naturally slow down as the unemployment rate got so low because there would be less people to fill all these open jobs. So it's an interesting phenomenon for sure.
Right. The labor market is getting very tight, which is also why we should ask about wages. Important part of this conversation. We have it every time the jobs numbers come out this time of the month. They're up, but just what, a little bit?
Yeah. So this month they were up 2.7% year over year in May. which is heading in the right direction. I mean, the wage growth was much lower in previous years. It's still not quite satisfying to many people. Again, when you consider how low unemployment is, economic theory would suggest, and basic logic would suggest, that the lower the unemployment rate gets, the better wage growth becomes. And there are many theories as to why it's not stronger. You know, if you had 5 or 6 hours, I could go through all of them for you.
We have a minute and 30 seconds.
But in a nutshell, I mean, for one thing, labor force participation is still very low. So that's one sign that, yes, it's a strong job market, but there are still a lot of people on the sidelines that could potentially get pulled in. And that's that, and the automation in the economy, the technology is sort of keeping a lid on wage growth.
What about manufacturing? 18,000 manufacturing jobs added last month. It's worth noting in the context of these tariffs on steel and aluminum that the president is putting on our allies around the world.
Right, 18,000 this month, 23,000 on average for the full year. Now, if you compare that to, say, the 2015-2016 years, the average of those 2 years was about 3,000, so very much stronger. And in theory, the tariffs on steel and aluminum, and if they follow through on any of the other products, such as cars, in theory, it should boost demand for U.S. products and hence add to jobs growth. But there are a lot of potential pitfalls with trade policies like this. I mean, yesterday we heard from U.S. trading partners in Europe and Mexico and Canada with their retaliatory measures. So it's not without risk. It's a risky thing to do for sure.
The other thing people are talking about today is the fact that President Trump broke protocol by teasing this month's numbers on Twitter before they came out. So that was interesting. Mike Regan, senior editor of Bloomberg News, thanks very much.
Thank you, Peter.
And a story now about prisons and books. We start with the problem of recidivism, the majority of people released from prison eventually ending up back behind bars. Research shows one way to stop that cycle is through educational programs for inmates, and prison libraries are supposed to support those efforts. But that doesn't appear to be the case in Illinois, where for all of last year, the State Department of Corrections spent less than $300 on books for prisons. The Illinois Newsroom's Lee Gaines reports.
I'm spending the afternoon with Chicago Books to Women in Prison. Half a dozen women are sorting and taping up boxes of books in the basement of a church. It's one of a handful of volunteer efforts dedicated to sending reading material to people in Illinois state prisons so that inmates can have access to books.
It could even be the case that in a roundabout way, the books that we send to women are actually stocking the prison library more than their budget will allow.
Vicki White, the president of Chicago Books to Women in Prison, is talking about general prison libraries, places where inmates can read fiction and nonfiction. While the state prison system is required to buy books for their law libraries, there's no requirement to purchase other kinds of books. Megan Maurer is a former prison librarian at the Robinson Correctional Center in southeastern Illinois. She says state prison librarians, well, they have no money to buy fiction and nonfiction books.
I can confirm that there is no budget for the general library in Illinois Department of Corrections, at least as of when I left about a year ago.
And the data backs her up. Last year, the Illinois Department of Corrections, or IDOC, spent less than $300 on books for educational programs across more than two dozen correctional facilities. Compare that to the roughly $750,000 IDOC spent on books every year during the early 2000s. That's according to documents obtained through a Freedom of Information Act request. The drop-off in funding can cost the state in the long run. Research shows education programs reduce recidivism rates, and libraries play a role in that work. Lois Davis researched prison educational programs for the nonprofit RAND Corporation.
We showed that for every dollar that a Department of Corrections invests in education programs, they can save up to $5 in reincarceration costs.
Maurer, the former Illinois prison librarian, says books can help people develop a plan for what they want to do when they're released. That's what Julius Mercer did. Mercer's life spiraled out of control due to undiagnosed mental health disorders and substance abuse. He was sent to prisons four times between 1994 and 2010.
With a criminal background like mine, it's hard to get a job. How can I still flourish?
During his last stint behind bars, Mercer decided to change his life, and he turned to the library where Maurer worked.
I was able to put a plan by reading these business books on marketing and stuff. And I told Megan Maurer, when I get out, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to speak, and I'm going to get my book going. I'm going to get it self-published now, and that's what I did.
Despite Maurer's efforts to make the library the best it could be, Mercer remembers the collection as lacking.
A lot of the books are antiquated because it's the least of their priority. So they provide just enough to meet the standard and not go over their budget because they want to use their money elsewhere.
I reached out to the Illinois Department of Corrections for an interview. Officials there declined, but did confirm that there's no specific appropriation for library reading materials. And they offered no explanation for the steep decrease in funding for books since the early 2000s. Maurer, the former prison librarian, says the state prison system does care about education and reducing recidivism. But the prison system also has to pay for health care, clothing, and food for inmates. It adds up. And because they're not required to buy books, it's an easy thing to cut.
Then there's the library and, you know, we don't get a budget.
IDOC says they partner with public libraries and groups that donate books to inmates. But Vicki White, the president of Chicago Books to Women in Prison, says all volunteer groups like hers can only do so much.
We can't reach everyone and we can't provide the complete level of support that is needed out there.
White says they'd love to close their doors and give away all their books if the system no longer relied on donations. But without greatly increased funding to improve libraries and education programs, she says they'll continue to do what they've always done, send books to prisoners. For Here and Now, I'm Lee Gaines.
If you're a high-altitude climber, you know the name Charlotte Fox. Even if you're not, you may remember the famous huddle scene in Jon Krakauer's bestseller Into Thin Air about the disastrous 1996 blizzard on Mount Everest that killed eight climbers. Charlotte Fox was in a group of those staggering down who huddled overnight rather than risk walking off an edge. She wrote afterwards, "Then began the longest night. The temperatures dropped to minus 40. The winds increased to 70 miles an hour. We'd had little sleep, not much to eat or drink for 2 days. We were out of oxygen, and we'd just summited the highest mountain in the world. We were fried. I had the weird sensation of my eyes freezing inside my head. How would we survive?" Charlotte Fox did survive, even though her eyes and her contact lenses froze. She was already known as one of the most accomplished female mountaineers and went on to summit more peaks. So as her friend Allison Osius writes, after Charlotte had survived so much up high, it was stunning and profoundly sad when she died a few days ago, falling down her own stairs. Allison Osius is the executive editor of Rock and Ice magazine. Allison, what a shocking loss for you and the climbing community. What made her such a great climber?
Well, she'd done 5 8,000-meter peaks. That's really a lot. She'd done Gasherbrum II, Choa Yu, Everest, of course, Manaslu, and Dalagiri. Dalagiri is a hard mountain. She did it last year. She did it at 60.
She ski patrolled for 30 years. By the way, did the seven summits, we should say, and was so skilled as a climber and skier, but also what? I mean, what was it about her that seemed to make her shine in the climbing community?
Oh, Charlotte was such a character. She just lived life so fully. She lived large. She got after it. She had a big, loud laugh. She was just fun to be with. If I was going somewhere and knew she was going to be there, I was really looking forward to it.
She had just turned 61. She told everybody how much she loved being in her 60s. When you said you looked forward to seeing her, you and others were on your way to stay with her at Telluride for Mountain Film in Telluride, an annual festival. So people were staying with her at the house. This terrible accident. What happened? Did she just slip?
She was found at the bottom of her stairway. When you go into her house, you go in at the top floor, and there were a lot of stairs.
And, yeah, because that's common in mountain you know, ski communities.
Yeah, it was a house that was on a hillside.
Yeah.
And I was going to Mountain Film. I couldn't wait to get there and see Charlotte and see Kim and see the others in the house and just catch up. And I knew it would be fun and we would laugh.
Look, we remember that scene, that famous nighttime huddle on Mount Everest. What did she tell you about what she thought when she was in there?
We didn't talk about it very much. She once jokingly referred to Everest to me as that which we don't talk about. And so I left it alone. We just went climbing a lot, and we had a great time. I climbed with her in Aspen and in Maple Canyon, Utah, and in El Dorado Canyon on the Front Range. I only maybe brought it up a couple of times, and I asked her at one point what she was thinking in the huddle. And she laughed, and she said she thought, well, old girl, it's been a good ride. No regrets.
Yeah. And she wrote in that piece, which we'll post at herenow.org, I'm 3 for 3 on 8,000ers, pretty damn good odds. Time to go to some lower peaks to climb some technical routes with just a few friends. You can just as easily get killed there. But with so many mountains in the world, why not mix it up? Altitude isn't everything. I mean, almost foreshadowing. You can just as easily get killed. You know, why not go for the heights?
Well, you can. Well, you can. And she actually went back to the big mountains. She did so much. Again, she did climbs in Aconcagua, Denali. She climbed in Russia and Antarctica. It's really hard to remember all that she did. Yeah. But she also, more recently, had gone back to the 8,000-meter peaks. And I think it's quite amazing that at 59 and 60, she did two more peaks.
Allison Osius, again, executive editor of Rock and Ice magazine, a friend of Charlotte Fox's, who just incredibly died earlier this week after a fall at her home, after climbing some of the highest heights in the world. Allison, thank you so much.
Yes, you're welcome, Robin.
Torrential rains have triggered deadly floods in southern states over the past few days. In Ellicott City, Maryland, a National Guardsman died on Sunday when a wall of water from the Tiber-Hudson River came rushing down the town's picturesque main street. At least 30 people were rescued, and the calls to 911 were frantic.
Are we going to die, ma'am? I just got so...
No, honey, I'm going to do my best so that does not happen, okay?
I have a lady stuck in a building over here across the street from me.
What's it?
8141, and the water's getting higher and higher on her.
Angie Tersigal owns Tersigal's French Country Restaurant on Main Street. It is, unbelievably, the second time in 2 years that a once-in-a-thousand-year flood destroyed her business. Angie, welcome. This must feel like deja vu. What kind of damage are you looking at?
Our basement is took on just about 70 inches of water. So I'm regularly looking at mud-splashed walls. Our wine cooler is on its side. Refrigerator and freezer are floating in water. Linens soaked in mud. It's a little overwhelming.
Well, I want to play a piece of tape from a video that was taken in 2016. And this is the last time your restaurant flooded. Customers are inside the restaurant. They're gathered at the window. It is pouring rain. And outside, the street has become an absolute raging river. Cars are floating by the window.
There's people in the water.
Oh, my God. Oh my God.
And there are people in that vehicle.
Oh, my God.
Angie, a flood like that is already a once-in-a-lifetime event. You've lived through that experience. Were you prepared for it to happen again?
I thought when I closed the lid on the box that said Flood 2016, we were putting this behind us. And we really did just close that box about 4 months ago with wrapping up paperwork and tax forms and tax credits and unemployment insurance. And on Monday, we were given 10 minutes to be in the building, and it was the very first thing that I got out.
I understand you had to lay off staff. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah. We laid off everybody on Monday.
How did that go?
It's painful. We have one employee that's worked for our family for 35 years, and this is the second time in 2 years I've made that call. And on Sunday, we had a 16-year-old girl in our building with our staff, and all I kept thinking was, what are her mom and dad thinking? It's hard. We have a small staff, and we're close, and they're like family, and to make those calls is heartbreaking. And then every single person said, when the time comes, we want to help clean up.
Well, and that's just one of the reasons why this process will be very costly. I mean, what about insurance? Do you have it? I mean, are they willing to insure you again?
So this time around, we do have flood insurance. Our building is exceptional in that even after the 2016 flood, we were not moved into the floodplain. So for us to get flood insurance wasn't as difficult as some other people or nearly as costly. So from a financial perspective, for us, this time is easier. My husband and I bankrolled our previous rebuild.
To the tune of how much?
Over $120,000.
Wow. Some people in town must be wondering if there should have been lessons learned after 2016, that the government should have made changes to the banks of the river or something like that, or somehow made the town more resilient to flooding after it ruined people's lives, ruined your life 2 years ago. I mean, do you think about that?
I think about it all the time. We've had several flash flood warnings since the 2016 flood. And every time I've always thought I have to put faith and trust in these officials. But you can't stop 10 inches of rain in 3 hours. And some of the projects set forth could take 10 years.
So now what, Angie? I mean, you're faced with this monumental task of cleaning up and rebuilding and opening for business again. You know, but this happened, a once-in-a-lifetime flood happened twice in 2 years. And you know, you must be thinking whether it's worth it if a third time could happen.
I do think that. The position is a little bit different for us. We own our building. She was built in 1890, and she's really structurally sound. And it's not so easy to walk away from that. And our restaurant has been there since 1990, and we've been on Main Street since 1975. And I have said a few times, like, I'm the rainbow unicorn of this rebuild. Because I'm just going to keep moving forward. I don't, you know, it's like at this point in time, we've come too far. We can't go back. So if this happens a third time, we might be having a different conversation.
Well, Angie Tersigal, your mood is to be admired, I think, after this. You're the owner of Tersigal's French Country Restaurant in Ellicott City, Maryland, flooding for the second time in 2 years. Good luck, and thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.